Climbing Gold is a production of Duct Tape Then Beer.
Hey everyone. This season on Climbing Gold, we dove into the present and future of our sport. We saw a lot of positives and ran into some of the difficult parts of our sport and grappled with some of the growing pains as this next chapter in climbing unfolds. Today, on our final episode, Alex and I are going to sit down with our executive producer, Lisi Hendricks, and our producer, John Bergman, and look back at some of the learnings from this last season and make some guesses about what the future holds for climbing. All right, so this season, we've talked a lot about how much competitive climbing has grown, evolved, and professionalized in the last 5 to 7 years. To use John's metaphor that we've been working with, it's grown up and it's kind of ready to move out of the house and do its own thing. You know, what did you all learn or find the most interesting about this season?
This season, you know, I'm like, oh, this is my childhood. You know, going from a scrappy youth team and doing some competitions to seeing the competitions get a little more professional to seeing it all start in the Olympics this season. I'm like, this has been my entire life of climbing, basically. Whereas last season, it was like crazy stories that I'd never heard.
I don't know if I already kind of knew about the evolution and whatnot, but it was cool. For example, I think of like Alex Johnson mentioning that she and Alex Puccio were sleeping on gym floors in her episode and stuff like that. And Alex Johnson and Puccio, they were doing that. That was like 2008, you know, 9, 10. That was only a decade ago. So when you think about how much progress has been made on the comp scene, and particularly on the American, with American comp climbers, in just a decade, that's pretty incredible. That's a lot of progress in a short amount of time.
Yeah, even in the last 5 years, I think somebody was telling me, was it on this show that someone was talking about Sean Bailey sleeping in his rental car and doing the World Cup circuit? That's pretty, you know, that's only a few years ago.
Oh, how things have changed.
Yeah. In just like a few years, right? That's incredible. So, it's cool to think, wow, if it changed that much in the past just a few years, I wonder how much it's going to continue to change in the coming years in ways that maybe we can't even imagine.
Is it going to continue to evolve as quickly as it has in the last few years? Or do you even think it's headed to a place where it becomes a huge sport, like more about the money, like the NFL?
Well, that's an interesting question. Do you actually think it will keep changing at that pace? Or do you think it's just going to change up to a certain point, basically grow up a little bit and then stabilize again? Because I personally kind of think that it's going to reach a certain threshold where it's like a normal competitive sport, like just a little bit more adult, and then stop there and not continue all the way to the NFL or something.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what would the comparable ceiling be? Snowboarding or something like that? Where it's, you know, there are household names that are the stars and there's a thriving fan base, but it's certainly not the NFL or the NBA or something like that.
Or maybe competitive surfing would be a good example. Because, I mean, there are definitely a lot of fairly household name surfers, despite the fact that not that many people surf, really. That's weird.
I've thought about that a lot, too, with surfing. It's tricky because surfing, it's like you can get inspired by it, you can get into it, but unless you live on the coasts, your options are pretty limited, which is totally different than climbing, which is like if you're getting stoked about it, everybody now lives within, you know, or most people live within an easy drive to a gym.
It seems like surfing culture, though, has like became way more mainstream at some point. And just from the standpoint of like the clothes that people wanted to wear and the way they wanted to act, versus climbing culture hasn't really hit that yet.
Yeah, that is true. You could go to like a mall in middle of America and go to I think that store is called like Ocean Pacific or something. Like I have a memory from my childhood or whatever, like where you could kind of go dress like a surfer, even though
you've never touched water before.
Yeah, exactly. Like it was, it did a good job of like exploding the surf culture to carry on consumerism in the U.S.
But that's why I think it's not that unrealistic for climbing to reach that sort of a point, but probably not really much further.
We've talked a lot about how stories are really crucial to holding the climbing community together. Like that is something that is really important. And they used to be shared around campfires, in climbing magazines, and more it's getting a little bit more, disjointed. But certainly in the past, like, each generation kind of had like these moments where everyone would be like, holy cow, look what happened. When Lynn Hill freed the nose, Sharma did the first 515 on realization. And I'm not sure that comp climbing it hasn't given me that, or I don't think it's given most climbers that, maybe until now, because the men's final at the Olympics was like a moment. It was one of those stories, and something that people who saw it will remember and talk about, because, like, I won't forget our entire family standing around the laptop, like, cheering our brains out. It was incredible.
It's funny you say that about the Olympic finals, because literally yesterday I was filming with somebody who happened to be, like, not really a climber, but he was at the Olympics filming some of the equestrian sports, and I think some of the surfing, but basically he was just at the Olympics doing, a certain type of filming. And he said that he was filming with some Austrians when he was like, man, and did you see the Austrian guy in finals? Like, wasn't it crazy? I was with a bunch of Austrians and they went insane. It was like such a moment. I was like, oh, it's pretty funny to hear a non-climbing cameraman talk about, that moment from climbing at the Olympics. I was like, oh, you're right. I mean, it was a very dramatic finals, particularly if you're Austrian.
Overall, like, kind of from what I'm hearing, the Olympics, were not this immediate boon to climbing. Nothing has magically changed. Is that kind of like what you guys have also kind of heard?
I do think that's true. And I've talked to some other gym owners, and I think the big expectation or the big hope was that after the Olympics, we would see this huge, gym owners would see this huge influx of people going into the gym saying, oh, I saw climbing in the Olympics and I want to try it. And most of the people I've talked to, that has not been the case. I think there's probably extraneous factors there, like being still in a pandemic and stuff. And so people might be reluctant to go to the gym like they normally would. But it's interesting. I was talking to somebody and they said, yeah, ever since the Olympics, I haven't had anybody come into my gym saying they want to try climbing because they saw it in the Olympics, but I still get people saying they want to try it because they saw Free Solo. So it seems like maybe the Olympics, at least in the immediate sense, hasn't had that impact that everybody was expecting in terms of participation, but I don't know.
Just because it's show the Hollywood, that's the real driver for climbing. Mm.
Yeah.
Dawn Wall, Free Solo.
Yeah.
Now The Alpinist.
Yeah.
It's all about those Hollywood movies.
Yep.
Well, I wonder if it just takes longer for the Olympics to, because of, when a new sport is in the Olympics, it doesn't get mainstream views.
Yeah, it doesn't get the coverage.
Yeah. So I wonder if it just takes longer for people to watch it and adopt it.
That's a good point, because, I think of snowboarding, its debut in the Olympics. Many of us think of Shaun White, the Flying Tomato, as kind of like the face of Olympic snowboarding. But when its first debut, it wasn't even half pipe. They weren't doing tricks. They were like racing like skiers. And there's a lot of similarities between, our debut and snowboarding's debut.
You could definitely imagine LA 2028 having a big impact for gym climbing in the U.S. because by then it will have matured enough that, it'll be domestic. U.S. competitors will almost certainly be in contention for medals. I can see that having a much bigger impact.
Yeah, and even at that point, there might be more colleges that do it. It might be NCAA sanctioned, so there might be like college scholarships for climbing, right? Who knows? So I think that's a good point.
I'll finally be able to go back to college.
Get that college scholarship.
Yeah.
You look forward to that. I have nightmares about that. That's like my one recurring dream, is like where I wake up and I find out that I never finished my like Spanish credit and I have to go back and I'm like in the dorm and I'm like, why do I live here? Why am I here? That is like my most, just to share that. Sorry.
Is everybody else in the dream the same age as you, or are they all
no,
still college
all younger, and I'm like 40, 43 and just being like, what am I doing here? It's terrifying.
Dude, at that point, you may as well be doing an anthropology degree. you're like, I'm stuck amongst a different generation.
Yeah, totally. Is this also just maybe that the Olympics don't have the same cultural cachet as they once did?
That's definitely something that is worth considering, is do the Olympics in 2021 have the same impact that they have for decades previously, impact on pop culture and kind of public consciousness and all that? I don't know. Maybe not. Does the Olympics mean as much today as it did back in like 1984 when Mary Lou Retton, you know, wins gymnastics and she's on the Wheaties box and like all this stuff and she becomes a household name? Does that happen with the Olympics nowadays? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to agree because I think there, you know, like if you look at Instagram, for instance, there are plenty of people that are huge influencers in the climbing world that have, you know, 100,000 followers, that have the same amount of followers as people that just competed in the Olympics.
But doesn't that make you sad?
Yeah, a little bit, but it's also really interesting, right? Because it means that, you know, anyone can reach people these days. Whereas in 1984, that wasn't the case. You know, we were told who to look up to. And now people, because of social media, can kind of choose who they want to follow.
I'm like, I don't know. That's a very optimistic way of framing it. It's like, or they get deceived into who to follow.
Yeah. That's a whole different discussion.
That is a whole different discussion.
Climbing Gold season 3.
The algorithm.
If climbing were to make a leap where it became something that very casual climbers watched, you know, online or on TV, what would it need to do that?
I'm curious about that. Do you really think there are that many fans of climbing who aren't already committed climbers?
I think that climbing has a hard time translating people that aren't climbers into fans of competitive climbing. Because if you look at other fringe activities or really any other sport, the field of play is the same in competition as it is in just practice or, you know, real life, essentially. And, you know, like surfing competitions are held in the ocean and skateboarding competitions are held in skateboarding parks and, you know, on and on. And so I think it's sometimes hard for people that, you know, experience climbing via Free Solo or, you know, the Dawn Wall or the new movie, The Alpinist, to look at indoor climbing and to see the pathway between outdoor to indoor sports, and to feel the same excitement that they feel when they're watching something like Free Solo.
You're saying that watching a World Cup lead competition isn't as exciting as watching Free Solo?
Correct.
I find that weird. Because I always find that when the streaming service lags out weirdly and you know, you don't know what happened to the competitor, I find that pretty dramatic. And you're like, did they make it to hole 37 or did they fall clipping? It's like, man, what if they fell clipping? It could have been a big whip.
I think this might say something about your Wi-Fi, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know.
I think one of the things that can really help get over that and get some of those fans is a once in a lifetime star, a crossover star. Because I think back, all of us here probably remember when Lance Armstrong was winning all those Tour de France events. And cycling, I think, can be pretty complicated. I think it's a pretty intricate world. And yet people that weren't necessarily cyclists were kind of drawn into that because they saw that he was doing something incredible. And that those summers when he was winning all those Tour de France's, you would just like the Tour de France was just on all the time and it was being talked about all the time. It was wild to have a niche sport like cycling suddenly kind of on the level of fandom as something like the NFL or the NBA. I don't know if it obviously didn't last, but I always remember that.
It went down in flames.
Yeah, right. So it's like, I don't know if climbing obviously doesn't necessarily want to follow that trajectory, but that is proof that these niche sports can develop huge fan bases.
Though actually, even if it did follow that trajectory, it probably still would be good for competition climbing. Because just the fact that any of us know anything about competitive cycling, I mean, that is a product of the phenomenon that you're talking about. You know, I read Lance's book and I was all into it. I was like, this is amazing. And you know, I think you're totally right that a charismatic megastar could definitely make climbing cool.
Yeah. Charismatic megastar, like with an incredible story, right? With an incredible story, with dominant performances, hopefully just without the whole like conspiracy to commit fraud with performance enhancing drugs and like the, you know, sort of almost international trafficking of banned substances. But yeah,
yeah, it's true. I mean, it's funny to say because it's like, oh, if only we had the charismatic megastar, but that's such a rare, I mean, like you said, like that you need all of these ingredients to fall in place on top of the fact that the person needs to be dominant to the point where we've never seen it before, right? Like it's...
Well, and we had that in Chris Sharma for outdoor climbing, and I mean, that's what we covered in season one with the Chris Sharma episode. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a big part of the growth and popularity of climbing in some ways, but we just haven't really had that in competition climbing, or at least not in this generation.
Do you think if Sharma had wanted, it's hard to kind of think back because that was, the X Games was the big thing and the IFSC circuit was not where it is now. The IFSC didn't even exist. It was still run by the UIAA, those competitions. But like, do you think if Sharma had dedicated himself more to exclusively the comp scene, we could have seen climbing become kind of this popular household sport? Like other sports?
Yeah, certainly to some extent. I mean, if Chris Sharma had Adam Ondra's desire to train indoors and to win, and, you know, was just a little bit less zen and maybe smoked a little bit less weed, you know, it's, you could definitely see that climbing could have taken a slightly different course.
Yeah. Somebody needs to write that fan fiction.
Yeah, you should. You should. That's your next book.
Yeah, you should.
Chris Sharma with Adam Ondra, like just putting together this charismatic megastar from 2001.
Yeah.
After the break, we talk about the drawbacks and upsides to growth.
I think that we all agree that the infrastructure, the resources that have been poured into climbing, you know, in the last 10 years, it's good for our athletes. It's easier to make a living. There's different paths forward towards professionalism. The training and the health and the knowledge, all those are trending up. And hopefully that equates for a healthier professional side to the sport. But my question is the growth in climbing good for the average climber?
I think it might be better for the average climber because if ultimately it creates a situation where there's more money and more interest in the sport, then better gyms will be built and climbing will just be more accessible and easier to learn. So I could see that aspect of it being better for the average climber.
Yeah, I think the accessibility and the more money in the sport and thus better livelihoods for the people doing it, those are all benefits to what Lisi said. But I think there are potential drawbacks too. I mean, one of the big things this whole season has been, we've been talking about climbing culture and how do you maintain that? And I think that it gets tricky because it kind of, there's this question of then, well, okay, well, what is climbing culture? But I think when I think of climbing culture, one of the things I think of is the fact that it kind of feels like we're all in this together. We're all on the same level, even if we're not, right? Like if I'm at a gym, I could be sitting on the crash pads. It doesn't matter who I'm sitting next to. It could be Ondra. It could be some teen kid in the gym who crushes V13, or it could just be somebody who's like in there for the first time trying climbing. And yet somehow we would be able to connect and have a great conversation. There's not this separation, and I don't know if that continues as climbing continues to grow.
Why do you think that would change?
Well, I think for one thing, if you think about other sports, right? Like the athletes in other sports usually are not training in the same facilities as Like usually there's almost like there's like elite facilities. Like if you're a quarterback or something, you're not training at Lifetime Fitness, right? You're probably going to the some elite training facility, right?
No, that's interesting. Actually, you're right though, because we're already seeing that in Salt Lake City, let's say, with the Olympic Training Center. You know, the most elite climbers in the U.S. aren't really going to commercial gyms anymore.
Yeah, which I think is cool too. I don't want to act like that's necessarily a bad thing. I think the training center's awesome, and we've highlighted it on this in this season. I just think it is. It is a pin that we can put in the something that could change and continue to change.
You know, in some ways, though, that's the natural byproduct of. You know, we talk about a climbing superstar and how that's good for the sport and having fans and all that. But as soon as you start to have, you know, stars and fans and all those kinds of things, it does become much harder to train in a commercial gym. You know, and I'll just say from personal experience, you know, when I travel to random gyms, like if I'm in a city for work and I just drop into some random gym unannounced, you know, it's often a bit of a thing. You know, it's like I basically and it's interesting because as climbing gets more popular and there are more climbers doing it, like in the past and in some more rural places, I could drop into a gym and then basically just know that I'm gonna chat and like take a picture with every single person in the gym at that moment. But that's kind of fine because there'll be, you know, 20 people. And so, you know, you can spend the first 15 minutes of your session kind of like chit-chatting and taking pictures of people, and then you can just have your climbing session. But you know, in some of the more popular urban gyms, there is no end to the line. You know, it's like there's no, like I recently did an event, which to be fair was for Global Climbing Day. So, I mean, people were sort of expecting to come in for a moment like that. But I kept thinking like, oh, I'll just, you know, sign things and take pictures as fast as I can. Eventually I'll get to the end of the line and then I'll have a bouldering session. And the line never ended. I basically did 4 hours of, you know, almost ceaseless chatting and photos. Because in an urban area, people, you know, text their friends, folks come, folks leave the gym. It's like there isn't really a finite number. It's like, you know, I mean, that was in the Bay Area. So there's something like 8 million people living within an hour drive. And so it's like you just never reach the end of the line. You're like climbing is too popular.
Yeah, it's almost like the hierarchy is getting more solidified. And you know, because I think back like a few years ago, I remember a friend of mine was like, oh, yeah, like Adam Onder was in the States some reason. And he was like, yeah, Adam Onder like came into the gym and we were just climbing with him. And he was like, totally cool. He was just like climbing with all of us, helping us out with beta and all that, just as you would with any climbing partner. And then now I have a hard time thinking that would be the case.
The dude, I actually went to the gym a couple of days ago and this random guy was like, hey, how do I do this problem? And I gave him some beta and then he sent it next go. And he was like, I've been working on that for an hour. And he just hadn't thought of like a pretty simple little fix with like switching his hands on a hold. And I was like, and that's why I'm a professional. 25 years of practice. And I told him to switch hands.
It's like we have this sense, there's still this sense that you could go to a gym and bump into a famous climber, pro climber, whatever, and just like climb with them. And that's how it's been the case for a long time. I don't know if it'll be the case in the future. And that's certainly not the case with other sports. Like, oh, I was down the street, I bumped into this quarterback and we like threw the ball around for an hour. It's like this pro quarterback. No, that wouldn't happen. But it does happen in climbing. I don't know if it will continue to happen.
Though with climbing, it will always continue to happen outdoors. I mean, if you go to cliffs with the hardest routes in the world, you're always going to find the strongest climbers in the world. I mean, that's the beauty of outdoor climbing is that, you know, everyone will always climb on the same routes.
Yeah, unless though there could be, I mean, I don't know if this is the case, but if there was a crew there that had like their entourage, right, for filming it or something, and we're like, yeah, we're filming now, like go elsewhere.
But even right. Then, I mean, it's public land, you know, it's like you can't really kick people out. And if you try to, it's incredibly poor form. Mm-hmm. I mean, I rolled up to the crag with an entourage yesterday and it was kind of douchey, but it was fine. Lizzie was there. She survived. I don't know.
Yeah, barely.
Yeah. With that douchey, it's hard to tell. But it's like,
well,
we
when
have
you
to
send
sometimes.
My project in my face, it makes it really, really hard for me to.
But I validated your beta, didn't I?
You did.
I validated. That's like the I stole your project, but I used the same beta that you were trying, so it doesn't.
No, didn't steal it because other people had done it, and they were too afraid to use her beta, but I used her beta, and I thought it was very good, and I thought it was the best way. So that's something.
Let I validated your beta. Definitely deserves to be on a T-shirt. Yeah.
No, Alex Honnold validated my beta. There you go.
That
deserves to be on a t-shirt.
No.
So we just mentioned the training center as well as the reality that there is a growing stratification in our sport. One of the next efforts that USA Climbing mentioned was building a $20 million training facility for the elite climbers, sort of like a castle on the hill that's absolutely world class, and sends up some red flags or maybe questions in my mind. It's like, is that really what we should be doing? Like if we were going to spend $20 million, would we be better served if we spent that on outreach in urban areas where most of the gyms are, or, you know, help create subsidized youth programs with better coaching, better resources, or, you know, maybe even supporting more gyms like Memphis Rocks? What instead of like walling off our sport, what if we use those resources to start opening our arms?
Well, it depends what your goal is. I mean, if your goal is to have the strongest climbers in the world doing the hardest routes and winning competitions, then, you know, you should be building castles and like build nice training facilities. If your goal is to have a broad variety of people enjoying the sport, then you should definitely focus more on outreach and building accessible gyms. You know, it's like,
thinking about it, like being like more people included in it gives you the chance to find that breakout talent that has the charismatic personality, the story, talent.
I know what you mean, but I kind of disagree, because even if you find that breakout talent and you don't have the facilities to foster their growth, then, you know, basically if you don't have that training castle for them, then they can't really reach the peak performance.
Yeah, I think the Olympics changes things a little bit in that it's such a significant stage, and now that climbing has access to that stage, I think actually fits the end goal for both of those would be the same, whether you're building the castles, so to speak, to train the elites, or whether you're just using that money to create a more robust gym infrastructure for access and whatnot. If the end goal of building the castle, the elite training center and whatnot, if that leads to Olympic glory, gold medal, then that results in more people becoming aware of climbing.
Actually, though, I immediately am like, is that even true though? Because I mean, Nathaniel Coleman won a silver medal, and like, has that changed climbing? Like, is that driving growth in the gyms? Like, I don't know. I mean, I think maybe that's the common take is like, oh, well, if somebody wins in the Olympics, then it's going to drive a lot of people into the sport. But that's not really true necessarily, because, you know, really what drives people into the sport is whether or not the Olympics gets a lot of coverage, which presumably happens more if Americans win. But I mean, in this case, an American almost won, and, you know, there's zero coverage and nobody really cares. Kind of like, I don't know, maybe focusing more on the growth of gyms is the better way to get more people into climbing.
That's been one of the big things for me too with the Olympics. You know, what I want to see is, and I've said this before in this season, is that I want to see more media focused exclusively on comp climbing, which goes to our point we always say about comp climbing needs to figuratively, you know, move out of the house, to use the metaphor. And so I always want to see more media covering competition climbing, big media covering it, whether it's ESPN, Fox Sports, CBS Sports, NBC Sports. It'd be so cool if they would start covering competition climbing as well, these non-endemic outlets. And during the Olympics, we actually saw that. We saw glimpses of it, because all of those outlets were covering the Olympics. Most of them at some point mentioned climbing or ran a piece about climbing, comp climbing. So in a way, the Olympics, for me, I was like, oh, this it's possible, you know, because here it is. They're doing it in the Olympic. It's possible to have all these non-endemic outlets interested in climbing. And it was fleeting, right? Because now here we are after the Olympics, and of course they're not covering competition climbing. But at least we saw it can happen.
I like how your whole thesis of like climbing needs to move out of the house, and it's like basically went from like climbing needs to move out of the house you know, and go, or competition climbing needs to move out of that house. And now we're talking about it like building castles. It's like, it not only needs to move out, it needs to build a mansion. Like, it's kind of like,
it's move like, out of the house, yeah, like, start your own career, yeah. Get your own.
Yeah, it's like, right. My parents' house is shitty. It's time to get out of here. Like, they're living in vans. Like, what the heck?
Dude, competition climbing is living the American dream.
Yeah.
After the break, we talk about the role gyms have to play in the future of our sport.
I want to say, I thought it was really cool. I don't think this really got focused on, but in the Ashima episode, when she said it kind of in passing, but she said that when she first started climbing, she went to her gym. She saw it in Central Park, and then she went to a gym, and her parents couldn't afford a gym membership, and so she was allowed to basically climb at the gym for free. And when she said that, that really struck me, because I was like, oh, I don't know if that would happen now at a gym. I mean, I know that there are gyms like Memphis Rocks and stuff that have it built into their business model to have kind of different tiers of paying. But I don't know. I don't want to speak for Ashima. I don't think that was the case for her gym. I think it was just the gym just saw that she couldn't afford it and was like, yeah, it's okay, well, just climb here anyway.
Or the gym saw a singular talent. I mean, I think that's probably still true for most gyms, that if a 6-year-old Japanese girl came in who could climb harder than most of the adults in the gym, I think most gyms would cut her a break. You know, be like, whoa, like, let's let this little girl climb for free because this is incredible. You know, I mean, I think that's probably true in most places. Because, like, I mean, every gym in the country, the manager still has some discretion with that kind of stuff. And to allow a kid who seems to be a prodigy, you know, it's like, I think most people would still let that slide.
It's just in the last few weeks, all the gyms in basically the Puget Sound region have basically, instead of just being like, oh, we found this singular talent, they're basically setting up that sort of scholarship program and broadcasting it and being like, hey, if you know somebody that would benefit from having, a free membership or discounted membership, like, there's a program for doing this and we'll do that. And they're using their connections in the community. They're using social media to actually do that call out. And it'll be interesting to see if that's, you know, an effective way of doing that. But it's, people are starting to think like that, and it's just an interesting.
Dude, a while back I was at a gym in Brooklyn, and there was this kind of young guy wandering around with no climbing shoes. He was just wearing a pair of socks, and he was just campusing things. And he definitely seemed like a beginner, but he was also campusing at a very high level. And I was like, huh. I was like, is this what happens when you can't afford rental shoes, but you're also prodigiously strong? And I was like, what an unusual, you know, I was like, I don't know. I was just struck by it. I mean, the fact that I still remember it means something. You know, I mean, there's the chance that he was, you know, a more experienced climber who just was like doing an arm day or something. But I really got the impression that it was somebody who was basically new to climbing, couldn't afford rental shoes, but was like, cool, I'll just campus. And I was like, wow, that's something, you know.
That's cool. You might have seen the next Chris Sharma there campusing.
Yeah, I think I would recognize him if I saw him again. So we'll see if I see him at the Crag in a year or two and he's campusing 514. I'd be like, whoa.
Yeah, you will not validate that beta.
No.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That brings up something we've talked about, is that the gyms are going to be a huge part in setting the culture. And that also means by default that the gym owners are going to play an outsized role in that, whether they're family run or part of like a large holding company with corporate investment. The culture is going to get set in the gyms. And I think that the Ashima story kind of epitomizes the community nature of the sport, like where we're willing to, you know, kind of help each other out. And that's been a part of it. And it's I think, one of the defining characteristics of our climbing culture, but are there other elements that you guys think of climbing culture?
Climbing culture, like what is climbing culture? That's such a hard question to answer because it's so many different things now. And even, you know, like really niche sport climbing culture versus like hardcore boulders versus trad climbers versus people that like, I feel like all those cultures are slightly different and shifting. But I think the one thing that goes across the culture is that the sport is hard at any level. And
yeah, no, it's always hard. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just always hard at any level or at any style that you're doing it. And so I think that's like the one thing that kind of connects it culturally.
It'd almost be interesting, like every gym should probably always have a problem set that nobody in its membership can do. You know, like that there almost should always be like an open project that they should almost like call in people for and be like, nobody sent this one for this month. Like that idea of being like, there's something, I don't know, like that might actually help kind of maintain some of that through line from history where there were things like midnight lightning where everyone walked past something, but nobody could do it. And then suddenly someone can do it. I don't know. It's interesting to think about like that there might be little cheats and little creative ideas that allow us to tap into some of those things.
I think one of the cool things fits to that point that would be, and this would be, I think, something that hasn't existed yet, which would be like for every gym, not every gym around the country, but for multiple gyms around the country to have the same route or the same boulder set, right? So like you could go into a gym in California and there's this really hard, whatever, 514B route with on kilter holds or something. And then you could go to a gym in Florida and that same exact route is up there. And so you have people all around the country still kind of trying this same gym route, which is kind of like the moonboard idea, right? But with gyms, with routes. And I know that there are companies that have toyed around with that idea, like Walltopia's got their harmonized wall system, which is like gyms around the country can have the same angle and the same holds and all that. But yeah, it's just an interesting idea to have like the equivalent of midnight lightning outdoors, but have that in a gym, in multiple gyms around the country.
Well, that's how gyms slowly edge closer to 24-hour fitness. You know, it's like,
yeah,
imagine a bunch of big boxes around the country that have the same walls at the same angles. You have one setter that just sets a handful of problems. They all get replicated on the different walls. And then anytime you go into a 24-hour climbing, let's say, you have the same sets, you know, on all the different walls.
Yeah, that's the risk, right? It's like a...
What, is that even a risk? I mean, I that might just be the future. You know, I mean, it's like certainly it's going to make the gym operators the most money because you don't need any staff.
Yeah, it certainly make route setting easy, right? Like, hey, here's a route. Put it in all 15 of our gyms or something like that, right? Like,
well, not even that. You basically have one, you know, flagship gym where you have a handful of good setters. They set the whole gym and then that exact set gets replicated in all the other boxes.
Yeah.
Which is depressing to think about, but I mean...
This sounds so dystopian, but logical.
Put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's coming into this industry totally from the outside, and they want to start a chain of gyms. Just like you say, okay, at like a chain of like McDonald's, we're going to have the same recipe for a hamburger in every single McDonald's, right? Like you'd say, okay, well, we're just going to have the same routes in every gym. There is as much as we kind of cringe at this idea or can cringe and pick apart at the pros and cons, there is a logic to it.
Well, do we cringe? Because every gym I go into now, I just go to one of the boards in the back and just use you know, the same training board that I use at home because I like the consistency. I like being able to train on the same problems. You know, it's, I don't know.
Yeah. Or maybe it's, I mean, this is like way down the future, but maybe it's just every gym is the same exact spray wall and people use their app just like you would for a moonboard where certain holds light up. It's like you use your phone and the certain holds light up on the spray wall and you're like, okay, that's my 512 route that I'm going to climb today at this gym.
That's futuristic. Actually, if you imagine that every gym is just a ton of holds, like every teen up full of holds, and then when you get to the base you're like, I want a 13B endurance route, and it just like lights up a nice 13B endurance route. You're like, that'd be cool.
I don't know, I feel like we might not be as far away from that as in terms of the technology to do it. Like that would be pretty easy to do, right? So you just create an app and you fill your gym's walls with light up holds.
If anyone does this, we expect a nickel for every new member. Just,
you know, a lot of the things we're talking about, I think the average climber, like someone like me, doesn't have like a ton of sway in. You know, like USA Climbing doesn't care what I think, right? I just think that for the average person, it's kind of like, well, these are some issues. They're big, but like, how do I actually like influence them? And I think part of the way you can influence them is by where you go to the gym and who you support. And like because we are, I mean, you know, if you live in a big urban area, you start to have options, right? There are, you know, chains in where I live, and there's also like starting to become like sort of more, I will say, quote unquote, like mom and pop places, like smaller gyms that have, you know, that are thinking about like setting towards like a climber that really cares about it. And they're providing coaching. They're providing like sort of like analysis of movement where they're starting to get that complex in the thinking. And that's really cool. And I really appreciate that there's still space for those kind of different environments to allow ideas to percolate up. So it is wicked to think about like, well, how could technology be better? And I think it is like kind of neat to think about, oh, there's the same route all across the country. But I also worry about that. I do think we have power as the consumers of climbing to think about what we want to support too. And it may not be as good for the elite people or the people that are making money off the sport.
I mean, I just wanted to say, I think part of the reason that you're not as interested in that kind of mass setting is because you happen to go to a gym that already has great setting. You know, it's like if you lived in a climbing desert, you'd be like, wow, that would be an incredible opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you value the creative side of it because you already have something
I have like
incredible. But it's like, but even in your town, you know, there are other gyms that have much worse setting in town, and you're kind of, and that's why you don't go there.
That is true. Thanks everyone for listening. It's been an incredible year. Thanks for all the encouragement and feedback and story suggestions. And right now it is time for us to take a break and actually go climbing. But before we do that, final thought.
Well, you know, we're just along for a wild ride watching climbing grow up.
Truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
It's fun to see. It'll be interesting to see 20 years from now. You know, I'll text each other, be like, huh, did that work out like we expected or not?
20 years, we'll all be climbing in different gyms across the country, but they'll all be the same sets. And we'll all be texting for beta on the same problems.
Together, let alone.
Yeah, it'll be nice. It'll be nice.
Yeah, well, I look forward to that. Thank you everyone for listening, for all the encouragement and feedback and story suggestions. If you got more of them, send them our way, because we're starting to think about season 3. Yes, it sounds like there'll be more Climbing Gold. This podcast is a production of Duct Tape and Beer. Alex Honnold is our host. This episode was edited by me, Fitz Cahal. John Bergman helped produce it. Additional editing and mixing from Cordelia Czars. Music today by Brendan O'Connell. Art direction by Anya Miller. Our executive producers are Becca Cahal and Lisi Hendricks for Duct Tape and Beer, and Jonathan Redzik and Ben Enge for RXR Sports. You've been listening to Climbing Gold.